and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show where we explore the many paths to transformation and aim to mine a few nuggets of gold that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, even though that might feel counterintuitive, just like the nightingale singing out in the dark. Thanks for joining me today. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, mindful at this time of the tragedy affecting more and more families as we've just marked World Suicide Prevention Day on the 10th of September. You're very likely aware of the rising rates of suicide, particularly amongst men. According to the Samaritans, their own figures for England only, in 2023, not the whole of the UK, show that the male suicide rate was more than 3 times higher than that of women, and overall the numbers had increased significantly, and that's a trend throughout the UK. But did you know that the industry where taking one's own life is most prevalent is the construction industry? Now, my guest today has recently conducted a study to find out why that might be so. Pippa Moy is a counsellor and psychotherapist. She's also a Reiki master teacher, a life coach, spiritual mentor and meditation and mindfulness teacher, so she is more than aware of this issue through her work. Later, Pippa puts forward a blueprint to tackle the issue societally as well as from a health point of view. But first, I started off by asking her to tell us about her recent study, which she undertook as part of a master's degree.
My research was about suicide prevention in the construction industry and specifically men in the construction industry. The reason I aimed at that specific group is firstly because men as a whole are more likely to take their own lives than women. If you look at the figures globally, the average is men are about 3 times more likely than women to take their own lives, and that is true for this country as well. If you look at the construction industry, the figures are about 4 times more high than that. So it's actually a fact that someone working in construction is 20 times more likely to take their own life than to die from an accident at work, which is something not a lot of people know. Probably more people should be aware of, because it's actually a very serious problem. In this country, 2 men a day are taking their own lives in the construction industry.
That's just extraordinary. It blows my mind, actually. So what is it? I mean, why? Did you come to any conclusions?
This is the burning question, and it tends to be seen as a bit of a mystery, but the more I delved into this, the more I discovered really, it's not a mystery at all. I should say that my own piece of academic research was about counselling for construction workers. The literature review that I did prior really looked at other people's studies, global studies, delving more into the risk factors and the causes for suicidality. So I'll talk about that first. The causes of suicidality actually go all the way back to before birth, which is something we also need to be more aware of. It tends to be someone taking their own life tends to be seen as an aberration, as a sudden act of craziness without any context. But actually, there's a lot of context. There's a lot of factors and circumstances which lead to that point. And if we're aware of what those are, then efforts to prevent that happening will be much more effective. So we have to go all the way back to the conditions in which someone is born. There are genetic factors, which we obviously cannot change, but there are prenatal factors such as the living conditions of the mother. If someone is born into poverty, they're much more likely to end up with risk of suicide. The reason being, they may be born prematurely, they may be born with low birth weight, they will be born into situations which are inherently stressful and probably have forms of childhood emotional neglect or forms of trauma or abuse. There is a host of conditions which will make a embryo or a child develop a very highly strung nervous system is like a lay person way of putting it. We're looking at the neurology of a person from the time when their nervous system is developing. And if we can address lives in general at that stage, we will save a lot of lives. This is obviously something which would have to be tackled on a global scale. We'd have to eradicate poverty. We'd have to have everyone in good housing. So that's, it becomes a political problem then rather than an individual problem. The later stages are a little easier to address, but we've already got the problem wired in. So people from backgrounds in poverty, for example, a family in which education is not a priority, a family in which the child witnesses violence and so they can't concentrate at school, a family in which they don't get fed so they can't concentrate even if they go to school. There's a lot of reasons why a child from a difficult background may not succeed in school. Then you add the possibility of undiagnosed neurodiversity or learning difficulties. So there's a whole cohort of kids who do poorly in school, probably get kicked out of school, seen as disruptive or difficult. They then end up in the armed forces, in prison, in the care system. And here's the catch. The construction industry specifically recruits from those areas. So they're bringing in men who are very vulnerable before they ever set foot on a construction site. So it's essentially a melting pot of some of the most vulnerable people we have in society.
That is really interesting, isn't it? It's really interesting that these issues start for so many right from birth or before birth.
On the positive side, that gives us many different points at which to intervene to prevent this problem. But what tends to happen at the moment is the so-called prevention is dropped in at the last stage of the process, whilst when the person is about to jump off the bridge.
And catching them before they do that is really difficult as well. Yeah. So then obviously counselling helps and you're a counsellor and psychotherapist, so that is your job. But where do you start with the counselling? Where do you start with the therapy? Because a lot of people don't even admit that they've got a problem.
The question of where you begin is a tricky one. I also find frequently that I might have worked with someone for weeks, if not months, before they mention the S word.
Right.
People are reluctant to mention it, and very often they'll go, well, yeah, I was thinking about it, but I'm not going to do it. And they're hasty to add that because they don't want me to instigate emergency procedures. And obviously it's a judgment on the part of the counsellor always to assess what is the level of risk here. Is this person in imminent danger, excuse me, or is this a thought that is not going to turn into an action? That's a difficult call to make. Maybe the person themselves don't really know if the thought will turn into an action. This is the thing. The act of taking one's own life is sometimes it's a sudden non-premeditated thing. Very often it is premeditated. Very often it's planned. And if a person absolutely has an intention to carry out that plan, they're not going to tell anyone because they don't want someone to step in and stop them. So it tends to be, it's almost like I equate it to first aid. It's the quiet ones you've got to worry about. The ones that are screaming and yelling and thrashing about, at least they're breathing. As a counsellor, I'm kind of trying to read between the lines a little bit on that. People mention thoughts of suicide way more frequently than you might think. It's not uncommon. And most of the time it doesn't get acted upon. It's when someone hits a low and they can't see a way out. And there are various theories about the process from the thought to the carrying out. In general, it's agreed that there has to be a kind of sense of entrapment, that not only my life conditions are unbearable, but I cannot seem to find a way out other than that way.
Yeah.
So if you're sitting in a room with someone and you can reframe the situation, look at possibilities that might not have been seen before, there are ways and means of introducing the possibility that there are other ways out, more productive ways out. And if a person leaves a room with a glimmer of hope, then they're on the right track. They've got something else to act on. Because the truth is, most people don't actually want to not be here. They just don't want to be in pain anymore.
Yes, exactly. That's what I've learned from various people since I've been doing all these interviews with people over the years. Absolutely. It's not that you don't want to be here. It's not that you hate yourself particularly either. A lot of people think that if you carry that out, that act, then you must hate yourself. No, you're just in so much pain. And I actually resonate with what you said about not seeing a way out.
Yeah, that's really the key. Getting to the point where there doesn't seem to be an alternative, like the
Yeah.
only way to prevent this pain. And there are many forms of pain, for men in particular, and I think we need to look at where men differ from women in these ways. There are different forms of psychological pain, if I can put it that way. Male depression is different from female depression.
Oh, wow.
Men express their depression and experience it differently from how women do. And unfortunately, that's barely recognized. It's really not recognized by the medical profession because it tends to be the doctor who's the first port of call. People see depression as you haven't bothered to dress well and your hair's a mess and you probably look like you haven't eaten and you might have been crying. And there's a general outward kind of expression of giving up. Whereas that being said, some people will be walking around doing their job and looking perfectly fine and having hell on the inside, but absolutely not showing it, men and women. Men are more likely to mask it. And
Yeah.
they're also less likely to phone a mate and bawl their eyes out than a woman
Yeah, true.
than women are. And this is really a large part of the problem. It's again a little controversial. It's seen as stereotypical, but if you talk to men, if you interview men, if you look at all the research that's been focusing on male mental health, the truth is it is harder for men to open up and that's probably because of the way they've been socialized. Little boys are taught from an early age that you have to man up and you have to stuff your emotions down and appear to be strong, etc. Girls from a young age are encouraged to express emotion. One thing that I notice very clearly in the therapy room is how women feel embarrassed to express anger. They've been allowed and trained to express all the other emotions, but anger, that's not feminine, which is unhealthy. Men, it's the opposite. You're allowed to have anger, but you're not allowed to have all the soft emotions. That's not doing anyone any favors. And for men, it's stifling. It means that all of those other feelings have no way out. And I find this isn't across the board, but it's common. That a lot of men have more difficulty identifying the language for the things that they're feeling because they have been trained to not feel it and not identify it. They've not developed the vocabulary to go with it. Now, again, there are some people out there campaigning for male mental health who will vehemently oppose that statement, but that's my experience. It's not to say men are stupid, men don't have the ability to express themselves. What I'm saying is that when it comes to the feeling, you have to be able to feel it first before you can name it. If it's been shut down to the level you can't actually find it, you've got no chance of naming it, expressing it, describing it to anyone.
So how do you get into that? As you say, I mean, we've all met people who would find that very difficult, men particularly, who would find that very difficult. So how do you get into it whereby they can express something around at least where they are in terms of how they feel?
Usually, I start with when you tell me XYZ, what's the feeling in your body?
Yeah.
And it might be tension, it might be tingling, it might be a sort of clench of the gut or the jaw or something like that, or the fists. If you can identify where it's gone in the body, you can start to kind of go, oh, right, well, that might represent such and such. Particularly if it starts with anger, which, as we know, is a secondary emotion. Okay, what's that covering? Is it frustration, grief, sadness? There could be any number of emotions underneath that. Starting with what's in the body. And I literally have lists of synonyms, and I offer them to clients. Would this be helpful? And many are very happy to take the list and have a look. And go, oh, so when I feel the thing, right, here's a word that describes that more accurately than I was able to identify. They find that really helpful to be able to recognize what's happening within themselves and then to be able to express it. I've also had male clients be able to work on their relationships because they can now communicate what they're feeling to their partner.
Wow, yeah. I
So
can see
it's
how that would work, yeah.
Yeah, incredibly useful. And it sounds, I think it depends how you deliver it. It's not delivered in a patronizing way whatsoever. It's like I recognize you as a intelligent adult, and I recognize that this is a difficulty, and here are some tools to help you to manage that difficulty.
Yeah. Yes, that's a really interesting way of helping people identify their feelings, the first step of getting through their darker times. Well, we'll hear more from psychotherapist Pippa Moy shortly, so do stay tuned for that, coming up right after these messages from our sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 with me, JJ, the practical alchemist, and my guest today, psychotherapist, counselor, coach, and mentor, Pippa Moy. Before the break, Pippa was talking about the various factors that lead to suicidality and how men in particular find talking about feelings difficult. Getting back to the construction industry, I could see how the correlation might come about, but that's not to put people in the construction industry down as deprived or inarticulate.
I know what you're saying. So there's a sort of there's a hierarchy of construction.
Yeah.
So you've got people at the top level who've got, architecture degrees and engineering
Yeah,
degrees and all of this.
exactly.
They've got they've probably a more affluent background, higher level of education. Generally, and if you're looking at who in construction would go for counselling, it would be more likely people on that level
There
and the
you go.
people in highly skilled trades. It's the people who are at the bottom of the heap from an economic perspective.
Yeah.
They are in insecure employment. They earn less. They probably went in with few or no qualifications. So they're doing unskilled work. And because they haven't had the schooling or perhaps a great background at home, they would have lesser language skills than the person who's
Yes.
been highly educated. So they may have more difficulty for that reason. And it's not to say they're not an intelligent person, it's just that
Exactly,
they
yeah.
haven't had the input to give them those skills. So, and I think that's a really important thing to recognize because as much as counselors and psychotherapists are meant to be neutral and non-judgmental, I've seen that in some cases that's not true. There is judgment, there is classism. If we're being true to our profession, we have to view everyone through the same lens, regardless of where they came from. Respect where they are. And from my perspective, the role is to enhance the capabilities they have, help them to develop new ones, empower them.
I
And
love that
so,
you said that. Yeah, I love that you said that because I always think that one's ability to articulate feelings and to talk knowledgeably about things isn't necessarily an indication of intelligence. You can
some
be
people
in.
are great with tools and just not great with words.
Yeah.
or great with maths and not great with words.
Yeah.
These are all skills, and some of us are brilliant with some and not with others. Everyone can't be good at everything.
Exactly. Exactly. You won't catch me doing very well on a building site, for example.
Same.
but yeah, so it is fascinating. And again, I come back to the how interesting it is that, you know, this can start even before you're born. If you're born at some kind of a disadvantage that really starts you going into life with anxieties. Can we say anxieties when you're talking about a baby, but the nervous system being compromised at that age, and then you go, you know, and then it goes forward. That is so complex and so difficult to pick up. But what would you like to see in place to stem this issue and so really address it at the core?
That's a big question.
I know.
With several answers, I
know,
I think.
I know, but I'm asking you anyway.
So, as I said, some of these factors would require change at a societal level. We would need a government that's willing to put money into, for example, making sure that reinstating things like vitamins for women who are pregnant and, you know, doing reforms into housing and conditions that people live in. There would have to be fundamental changes which support people and don't leave them to struggle, you know, and that's not what we have at the moment, and it's going to take a few years to turn that around if there are governments with the will. That's at the ideal level. What we can do more tangibly is tackle it through education and healthcare. I think those again would require some political will and some investment, but it would be quicker and perhaps simpler at those levels. So, for example, GPs need to have more awareness of the difference between male and female depression. They need to be able to recognize men will turn up and say, I've got a bad foot. What they're actually saying is, I want my life to end because I can't cope. But the person needs to be able to ask them the right questions get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
It's shown that a lot of men have been in touch with medical services not long before they take their own lives, but the correct interventions are not put in at that point.
And that's that's because the right questions aren't asked, is it?
I mean, essentially, even that, certainly the right questions are not asked and the right conversations are not happening. You know, if a GP's got 10 minutes and they're just trying to get you off the seat and the next person in, that really isn't enough. I mean, there needs to be, again, in an ideal world, some fundamental changes to how our GP services work, but also the emergency mental health. I've had clients who have turned up and said, I feel suicidal. I don't know why. I don't want to feel like this, and I don't know what to do about it. And they've been in touch with A&E, GP, tried to contact emergency mental health services. And that system at the moment in this country is pretty much broken. The waiting lists, the referral times, the system of hoops that have to be jumped through to get to a point of actually getting any help. People can wait years. They haven't got years if they're in crisis. And even when they do get to the end of that line, they might get six sessions of CBT, which if they've got deeply rooted problems from early childhood, is unlikely to be sufficient.
We've got charities though, like the Samaritans, who will, you know, talk to people at least if
they
they're
do.
In real
the
crisis.
Samaritans aren't allowed to tell people to not kill themselves.
What?
No, they. I know this from speaking to one of their top people, can't say who, but they regard their job as basically listening, because, and that in itself is more highly valuable than we realize.
Yeah. I get actually what I can kind of see the rationale behind that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, here's an interesting aside, but in terms of the prevention side, there tends to be one of the difficulties of doing suicide research is no one wants to mention the S word. There's a fear and a myth that if you mention the S word, it's going to make someone more likely to do it. Actually, research shows that the opposite is true. Even if you're just doing a survey and you're asking people with those kind of thoughts about what they're thinking and why they're thinking it, they will be less likely to go ahead and do it purely because someone has shown an interest. So the
And
fact of the Samaritans just saying, "How do you feel and why?" That's pretty magical, actually. It can be more effective than you might think. They're not sitting there trying to persuade people otherwise, because it really their job is to empathize, to understand that person's state of mind.
My late co-host, Dr. Mark Goulston, we had a show together. He passed away on very sadly at the end of last year, and we had a show together. He was a suicide prevention specialist, and he would say that really a lot of the time, just listening
Yes.
and just listening
Yeah.
to ha having and giving people the space
Yes.
to talk about what's going on with them
Exactly.
is so key.
And first of all, showing someone cares. Second of all, the process of talking it through very often enables people to find the answers within themselves that they can't find when it's just swirling around, you know. Our jobs as counselors and psychotherapists is not, we don't have a magic wand, but we help the person to organize this mess and get it in some sort of order so that they can see their way out of the fog.
And the show that I'm talking about was Hurt Less, Live More, and they're running the repeats this year in honor of Mark, who was a sad loss, and who would always say that in all his years he never lost one person. He was a bit of an angel, bit of an earth angel, and I miss him dearly. But so listening, just listening is important. It's very valuable.
So, going back to kind of what would be the things that I'd like to see, that, you know, more people need to be trained to listen properly, because what tends to happen is everyone's got an answer, and that's not what the person needs. They need to be heard and seen.
That's a very good point.
And there are schemes out there. There are training courses which exist. For example, you know, if you're in the world of corporate companies, you can get people in to train your staff in the right way to talk and listen to someone who's expressing these kinds of problems, which is helpful. It's not cheap, and it's probably not as widely accessible as it might be. So it's
Are we talking about active listening here, what people call active listening?
And kind of what to say and what not to say. And the right kinds of, and also if someone is in like active crisis, the right ways to respond to that, which is very useful. I think we need more of that. Really, these things are still very fringe and not everywhere. They really need to be everywhere. Going back to the point about education, obviously we have a bit of a rash of teenagers now taking their own lives, and we need to be aware of the age ranges at which people are at the most risk. For males, there tends to be a bit of a spike in middle age, and particularly amongst those in lower socioeconomic groups where perhaps they feel that they haven't succeeded in life as much as they could have, or maybe they've been through a divorce, maybe they've lost a parent. There's a point at which life becomes particularly challenging or questionable to a person. And what I wanted to add to that in terms of dealing with male depression and suicidality in particular is the shame factor, that men seem to be more heavily affected by than women. For example, if a man loses his job, that is going to weigh much heavier on him than a woman. And again, I might be accused of dinosaur talk here, but there is evidence to show that this is the case. Men in general still very much have a provider instinct or role in their mind. Whether that's nature or nurture is up for debate. It's probably a bit of both, but it's there. And not being able to provide, and the idea of letting people down. I hear that from male clients, and you can see it in descriptions of what's happened to certain people who haven't survived. Letting people down is a tremendous source of shame.
Yeah.
So that needs to be addressed. Not it's not like, well, you can't dismiss that and tell a person it doesn't matter. It does matter. If it matters enough for them to be standing on the edge of a bridge, then quite clearly it's extremely painful.
It matters a lot, yeah.
So there needs to be more education in general about what male psychology is and how it's different from female psychology, how male depression is different, how men have different coping mechanisms. They're more likely to act in rash or impulsive or dangerous ways, for example, than a woman, which, you know, it's only a short leap from that to doing something which could be life-threatening. So that awareness is helpful in terms of, well, how do I respond to this person? The fact that they are feeling really low might actually be more dangerous than we thought.
Yes, it's so difficult. There is no quick fix here, especially when you consider that the issues that lead up to potential tragedy have been factored in even before birth sometimes. I would very much like to see a national campaign to improve nutrition, especially in prenatal care. Even if we were to go back to post-war days when we were urged to take strengthening supplements like cod liver oil daily, rosehip syrup was very much a part of that drive and was given to children to boost their vitamin C intake. Now, you don't see much of it now, but you can make your own, and now's a good time to do it as rosehips ripen all over the country. I'll tell you how next time. Right now, though, it's time to take a short break. We'll be back with more from my guest, the psychotherapist Pippa Moy, right after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. I'm JJ, the practical alchemist. And my guest today is psychotherapist and counsellor Pippa Moy, who has conducted a study on suicide amongst construction workers. We've been talking about the statistics, and we've been talking about the differences in psychology between the genders. But there was something else that I wanted to hear Pippa's thoughts on. Here it is. I guess you don't always pick up on the signs, but what are the things that we can do in our daily lives to mitigate against this ongoing issue that we have in society? Is it just a question of talking more and listening more?
In a nutshell, there's also the problem of you can take a horse to water, because if someone is having great difficulty expressing what they feel or doesn't want to talk,
That's difficult.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the shame factor kind of ties in, not wanting to admit that there's a problem, feeling I'm a failure if I admit that I've got a problem. So as a society, what we need to be doing is reducing the stigma attached to mental health problems in general and what we expect of men. We have patriarchal society doesn't work for men any more than it works for women. We have ludicrous expectations. Why are men only, or the majority, expected to do the most dirty, dangerous, filthy, smelly, disgusting jobs? That doesn't really get questioned.
Yeah.
There's a concept of the disposable male. They do the jobs which are more likely to kill them.
Yeah.
We take that for granted. And then we wonder why they get stressed out. So we need to have more compassion for men in general. We need to have more realistic expectations. There's also this idea that, well, men are meant to be macho and providers and be able to fix stuff and do manly things and all of that. And then we expect them to also be soft and cry and tell us how they feel. Well, can you really have the best of both worlds?
Yeah.
So I would say as women, we have a large responsibility for the state of men. Women are the mothers. How, whether they allow that boy to say, I'm scared, I'm hurt, I need help, or whether they shut it down, is going to form the way he sees himself and the world and how he expresses himself. As sisters, wives, and any, we all have men in our lives. We have to allow men and encourage them to show how they feel and not put them down, ridicule them, tell them to man up.
Yeah.
And then how men treat other men, especially on building sites. There's a lot of bullying. It's harder for someone in that environment to admit they've got a problem because they'll get a sort of tongue lashing. That's not what they need.
A lot of it will be excused as banter, though, wouldn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it would. It would, but really, there's a lot of bullying. Some of it will be good-natured banter, some of it won't.
Yeah.
There is a lot of bullying goes on. And so we all need to allow other people to be vulnerable without ridiculing them at the end of the day.
Well, it's good that we are bringing this to people's attention more and more. And it's good that, you know, that people like you are around to help in these crises, although it would be fabulous, wouldn't it, if we just didn't get to this crisis, you know, if people just didn't get there.
Exactly.
That's
part of the prevention aspect, really, knowing that the men who are most vulnerable, they've generally that got lower levels of education and low insecure income, so their life is pretty much on a knife edge anyway. Then what tends to happen is you'll get something like a breakup, no access to kids, or a death. It's usually something relational, which is the final straw.
And those, actually, they just need that extra level of understanding and support that they don't tend to get.
There's numerous levels we can address that. Why are those people financially vulnerable? Well, because they're subcontracting to someone who's not being fair. There should be measures in place to make sure that doesn't happen, to make sure people get paid the right amount and they get paid on time so they haven't got that stress. They're not worried about paying for their child support or paying their rent.
Yeah.
There needs to be support for the coping mechanisms that frequently kick in, i.e. drink, drugs, gambling. That's where people tend to go when they're under stress, men in particular. Obviously, it ultimately makes the problem worse, but it provides a sort of quick fix. There's also quite a lot of risk associated with painkillers, partly because very heavy work will make your body hurt, but also some of those prescription drugs can become addictive in themselves. So those coping mechanisms need to be addressed. Again, the medical profession could have input there. Management of construction companies could have input there. But the people who are self-employed, tiny, tiny contractors, they haven't got the structure around them.
Yeah.
They're seen as hard to reach. That term is a bit ludicrous to me. It's like saying someone in a wheelchair is hard to get on a bus. You need to change the bus, not the person.
Brilliant. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, actually, all these people are in one place. They're a captive audience. So surely that's an opportunity to access them and provide resources where they are on site. In terms of what is shown to work, they have a scheme in Australia called Mates in Construction. It's now Mates in Mining, Mates in various industries with a similar demographic and similar kinds of problems, like it's dirty, hard, boring work. You might be away from home for months at a time. Similar kinds of issues. They have interventions at every level. So Every level of a company is trained, and they also have an outreach for the small individual one or two people companies, so they don't get left out. They train them as to what they need and how they can help others. They also provide support systems with key workers for gambling, addiction, debt, whatever kinds of problems the person is trying to manage. They provide input at every stage so that they're not on their own with it. And not being on their own with it is kind of 90% of the battle.
Yeah.
I've got help. Somebody cares.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that sounds like a brilliant scheme. And I have to say, people, with your background and your understanding, maybe that's that's something that you can get started. I'm putting you on the spot there, but it does sound like it's a brilliant scheme and something that would be great if it was rolled out around the world.
Absolutely. But, yeah, it's recognised by the World Health Organization as the gold standard. So,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing that work. And thank you for looking into a sector which, and a demographic which we tend to overlook so much, and bringing that to the fore. So, you know, congrats on all of your work.
Thank you.
And I think time to bring this conversation to a close, much as I enjoy it. And I know that you and I can speak forever. So, you know, we'll spare people that. But if people want to find out more about you and get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Okay. So the best way would be to email me. The email is pippa@silverray.co.uk. So that's PIPPA@silver-ray.co.uk. pippa@silver-ray.co.uk. By all means, drop me a line if you would like to discuss or get some information.
Fantastic, Pippa. Thank you so much for your time today. And I'm looking forward to seeing the changes that you helped to create in this area. So, but now for now, thanks very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.
You know, I have every confidence in Pippa's ability to get something started that will help men in particular who find themselves facing the end of the road. It's a big job, multifaceted, of course. But isn't meeting the basic needs of our community a fundamental tenet of healthcare? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Do let me know. You can get in touch with me through my website, thepracticalalchemist.uk. All my social media links are there too. And if you're looking to de-stress, you'll find some audio and video tracks on my website to help you do just that. None of the tracks is more than 10 minutes long, some are just 5 minutes, so you can easily fit them into your busy day. Or why not start a practice of just sitting in silence for 5 minutes every day? It's not as easy as it sounds for some of us, but just sitting, noticing what comes up, where you have any sensations in your body, not judging anything. You know, after a while, you might be surprised by how helpful giving yourself this space every day can be. But please, if you find yourself at that point where you think there's only one way out of all your troubles, and that's opting out of life altogether, and you're in the UK or the Republic of Ireland, please, if you do nothing else, call the Samaritans. You'll find the phone number and all the different ways to get in touch with them at their website, samaritans.org. That's Samaritans, SamaritansOrg. You'll find a listening ear there with no judgment, and sometimes it's easier and more helpful to talk with a neutral person who isn't a family member or even a friend. Now, outside the UK, you can find help through Befrienders Worldwide. Their website is at befrienders.org. Now, it's time for me to leave you right now because we're at the end of the show, but I want to send all my love to everybody who's struggling right now and anybody certainly who's really in the depths of despair and depression. Thank you for listening. Join me next time for more Practical Alchemy and more fabulous guests with some great information on how to be naturally healthy, not just mentally, but physically, spiritually, and emotionally too. Until then, it's goodbye from me, and of course, the Nightingale.